Prescriptions for Health with Dr. Len and Vicky Saputo, Mondays at 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Broadcast out of New York City, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on Monday, January 16th, 2012. I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicky Saputo. Thank you for joining us on our weekly Prescriptions for Health show on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com every Monday live from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time and from 12 noon to 1 p.m. Pacific Time. And remember that our shows are archived on DrSaputo.com and PRN.FM.
Today you hear Vicky's 2020 health tips at 20 after the hour and 20 to the hour. And we've got a great show for you today again that's going to include: can chlorophyll prevent cancer? Try that one on.
And can probiotics prevent a heart attack?
If sweets increase inflammation, what prevents inflammation? That'll be an interesting story.
And sugary sodas increase fat in surprising places.
And how about this? Can you die of a broken heart?
The medical use of insects. You know, we didn't get to that last week, so maybe we'll get to it this week.
That's a weird one.
And we have a lot more.
Right. Plus, if you want to join our conversation and have questions about our topics or about your health, give us a call at 888-874-4888.
So, can chlorophyll help prevent cancer, or does it cause cancer?
I guess it depends on the dose, huh? It's kind of interesting the way that story is put together. Chlorophyll, you know, is the main color that we see in plants. It's the magnesium in the chlorophyll molecule that does that, as opposed to the iron that's in the hemoglobin molecule in people. And so the chlorophyll and its derivative, chlorophyllin, actually do some interesting things. Mother Nature is remarkable at how she puts things together.
Well, I know one thing it's supposed to do is to prevent bad breath. I remember we used to chew that green chlorophyll gum and get green tongue so that we'd have sweet breath.
Sweet breath, yeah, indeed. Well, that's one thing, but we're talking about cancer and cancer prevention. What's interesting to me is that there are a large number of scientists who say you don't really need organic food because there are carcinogens in food itself. And if there are carcinogens in food itself, then, you know, what's the difference if you put a little pesticide on something? And,
well, let's just make it really carcinogenic.
Well, I've never agreed with that. But yeah, it's true. There are carcinogens in most vegetables. And in that setting, what happens is that the chlorophyll protects against the cancer that's in the food. Mother Nature is very interesting. She puts the poison in one form, and she puts the antidote in another in the same thing. It's much like in fruit. You know, there's a lot of fructose in fruit, and fructose we know isn't good for us because it turns into fat.
Which is why it's better to eat the whole fruit than to just drink the juice.
Well, that's because the antidote is the fiber and some of the other things that are in the fruit. So when you put that together, it does a lot to protect. Now, this particular study that was done, which was done at the University of Oregon, interestingly enough, on rainbow trout. You think, rainbow trout, what's that got to do with people? But it does have a lot to do with good research that applies to people. And what they did is they went ahead and put some chlorophyll, okay, in the water, and noticed that when they put carcinogens in at the same time in doses that are found in the natural environment, that the fish were actually protected from getting cancer. But if they put a lot of the carcinogen in there for some reason that nobody understands, the chlorophyll actually increased the number of cancers that the fish got.
So it sounds like it's with most things, moderation.
Yeah, it is. And it's again, it's trusting Mother Nature knows what she's doing. When they put lots of the carcinogen in the water with the fish, the number of liver tumors increased by about 50%. And the number of tumors in the stomach increased by about 40%. And it's interesting that this is that way. So the way the chlorophyll seems to work in people is that it binds with and sequesters the carcinogens, okay, that are in the GI tract after you've eaten them, and then they're just eliminated in the stool. So it's a nice, easy way to get rid of carcinogens that we eat, but only in normal amounts.
And another reason to eat your green leafy vegetables.
Indeed. Eat your green leafy vegetables, and what will happen? you'll be protected against the usual carcinogens that are found in food itself and in low doses because of what we've done to our environment. So that's the story. Eat your greens.
You know, another thing is, you know, we've been talking about the importance of intestinal bacteria and probiotics for years. Mm-hmm. And so can probiotics really prevent a heart attack? That's what's in the latest research.
Well, you know, we're finding out a lot of things about probiotics. And first, let's just quickly define what a probiotic is. It's really it's a combination of the microbes that live in the intestinal tract that should live there. Keep in mind there are thousands of different kinds of microbes in the different species of microbes in the gut. There's more metabolic activity in the gut than any organ system in the body. And that should alert us that it's not just there, you know, because it's there. It's there for a reason. And it's becoming more and more clear that the way the intestinal microflora works with us human beings is that it's in a symbiotic relationship with us. It does good things for us, and we feed it. We feed it the undigestible fiber that we eat. And if we have enough of that, which we don't in our diets these days because we have too much processed food, then we can nourish and the intestinal bacteria that live there that we'd like to have grow. And when they grow, they crowd out the microbes that you don't want there. And they probably do a lot of other things that are important in our bodies.
Well, another place people can get probiotics is in yogurt or kefir.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those are good places to get it, too. The kinds of things that it does may sound strange. One is it can help protect against getting asthma or hay fever. And it's an interesting relationship.
Yeah, who would think of that?
You wouldn't. And it also, some of those microbes can protect against inflammation in the gut. And they now have studies that show that they can actually prevent heart attacks. And this is weird. These studies were done in rats, but it's still good stuff. And what they found is that in a study that they did, they fed the rats either a standard diet, a diet that had an antibiotic called vancomycin in the water, or a probiotic. And in the standard diet, the rats had the normal expected rate for heart attacks. In the water with vancomycin in it, and in the probiotic water, what happened is that the incidence of heart attacks and the severity of heart attacks went way down. And you have to start thinking, well, how does that make sense? One is an antibiotic that kills the microflora, and the other is adding microbes to the gut. How could that make sense? They actually didn't discuss this in the article, but as I thought about it, it became clear to me that what's happening here is the vancomycin is killing a kind of microbe that we don't want there that can put us at risk for having heart attacks and probably strokes. That wasn't even tested. And in the case of putting a probiotic in there, you're still crowding out those bad bacteria, so you're lowering the number of microbes that you don't want there because they influence the risk for heart attacks in a negative way. It wouldn't surprise me a bit if the gut microflora and our relationship to it influence a lot of illnesses that we have and maybe either protect or cause them. And it's why we shouldn't be fussing around with changing around what that microflora is by using antibiotics or steroids or birth control pills or NSAIDs or many, many drugs that we're exposed to and many toxins in the environment because it would sort of pollute the gut because the gut's a very sensitive ecosystem. It's much like a forest.
Well, it's the largest organ in our whole body, so
the most metabolic activity of any organ in our body. Now, if you have a forest fire and you want to regrow that forest, you don't just throw a few redwood trees seeds out there or plant little redwood trees. It's going to take you 100 years for that to happen. What do you think happens when you put an antibiotic in your mouth and you swallow it?
It kills everything.
It kills, well, it doesn't kill everything. It kills the good guys, and it kills a few of the bad guys. And what it does is it selects out turf, growing media, where bacteria that are pathogenic bacteria can overgrow.
Get stronger.
That's right. And whether or not we get sick depends on how many of different kinds of microbes live there, because many of them make what are called endotoxin, which is poisonous to us. It's what causes leaky gut. It's what makes us sick. It can cause diarrhea. So if we get in a situation where we're changing that system, we're changing something that's like changing a forest. And you can't just take a few probiotics and think that somehow that's going to regrow your forest in a matter of a few weeks or a few days. Not going to happen that way. So we have a lot of thinking to do about how we're treating the ecosystem in our intestinal tracts, and have to recognize that, yes, it can probiotics prevent a heart attack? You bet. It's showing that it can. Can it prevent asthma? You bet. Can it prevent hay fever? Sure. It can prevent inflammation in different parts of our body. And that interrelationship may have a lot to do with autoimmune diseases and inflammatory arthritis and conditions like that, maybe even osteoarthritis. So this is kind of a new concept, and I'm happy to say that the medical profession is beginning to appreciate that probiotics are really important, and that the microflora of the gut is an important organ that has a profound effect on our biochemistry and biology.
And yet, I think it's interesting to note that when people go to the dentist, when they have like a valve problem or something, mm-hmm. They're frequently given antibiotics.
Well, that's to prevent seeding of pathogenic bacteria. Say if you're doing dental work that come from the mouth, go into the bloodstream, might settle on that valve and cause an infection called bacterial endocarditis,
I'm wondering if it would work, you know, to give probiotics instead. Of course, they probably haven't done that study.
No, but nobody's brave enough to try it. And I'll have to say that there are many valve problems that don't require any antibiotic treatment at all. For example, the most common one is a mitral valve prolapse, which a large percent of the population has. We used to treat those with antibiotics, but have found that by not using antibiotics, the risk is just the same. So taking an antibiotic has profound effects. You know, we used to think, I know when I was in medical school, we got a cold and everybody said, oh, here, have some acromycin, which is a form of tetracycline. Said, just take it because it can't hurt you. It won't do any harm. But it does.
It does, and it doesn't even fight a virus anyway.
Well, we do a lot of things that don't make a lot of sense. When I was in medical school and early part of my internship, we looked at the pineal gland as having no action at all, nothing at all. And when it calcified, I remember my professors telling me that when people came into the emergency room, because the pineal's dead center in the brain, that if you did a special test that looked at whether or not that pineal was in the center of the brain, would help you in cases of trauma, because if there was a hematoma, a collection of blood on one side, it would push it over a little bit to the other side, and that would be its value. And now we find out that the pineal has so many important functions that it's mind-blowing. And it's the same thing with the appendix. We thought, oh, just take it out. You know, if you're in there anyway, do what we call an incidental appendectomy.
So that you won't get appendicitis.
Yeah.
And now we've found out that it actually releases probiotics into our GI tract.
Well, it's a storage for it. So it's a blind sac, okay, that comes out of the area where the cecum is. And so when there's an infection in the intestinal tract, it all goes past the appendix because nothing can go in it because it keeps producing fluid that comes out of it. So it can't go into a dead space where it can't go. And its value is to continue to produce those probiotics and the biofilm, those chemicals that are in the appendix that help microbes live and be able to flourish. So what we have here is a topic that deserves much more attention and respect than we previously thought. So the microflora of the intestinal tract is hugely important, and we should be protecting it at all costs and not be doing the things that we're doing that disturb that system so that it can't protect us against things like heart attacks, asthma, hay fever, inflammatory conditions in many areas of the body.
Well, also when they were doing this study on the probiotics to prevent heart attacks, they also realized that it affected leptin production. So why don't you talk about leptin?
Okay, leptin is a hormone that's made by our fat, by our fatty tissues, okay? And it's produced after we eat a meal to suppress our appetite. So we like to have leptin around in large amounts, particularly in this epidemic, this era of epidemic of obesity and type 2 diabetes, because it should turn our appetites off. But the interesting thing that they found in this study in the rats where they gave them probiotics is that when they gave them the probiotics, that their level of leptin dropped and became lower. And when it became lower, that's when the benefit was there. If they gave leptin back, it reversed all that, and it was no longer protective against heart attacks. So is it the microbes? Is it the leptin? What association is there that we should be paying more attention to? And, of course, we're in the early stages of our studies on this, really in a very primitive way. And it just reminds me of how complex the human body is from the point of view of cellular biochemistry.
Well, the amount of sleep we get also affects our leptin levels.
Leptin is something
that has to do with our appetite and metabolism.
Leptin and insulin are both affected by inflammation. We'll be talking a little bit more about what causes inflammation that is related to our diets. So this whole subject is one that is coming into the forefront of medicine very slowly, but it's coming there. There are also interesting relationships with the microflora of the gut and causing other diseases, things like C. difficile and enterocolitis. It's the microbe that when it overgrows after you've given a lot of antibiotics causes a massive inflammation of the colon where there's bleeding, lots of mucus production, sometimes perforations of the colon, and a lot of a large percentage of these people die. And how do we treat them?
Antibiotics.
We use the vancomycin antibiotic, and what do? We wipe out every microbe in the gut with the exception of those that are resistant to the vancomycin. And, of course, those are the ones we don't want to grow because they are now they're not susceptible to vancomycin anymore.
So they can't be killed.
That's right. We can't kill them, so we have no way of getting rid of them. And if they're bad enough, we're toast. So,
everybody's so anxious to take antibiotics for everything.
I know. I'd have to say from time to time I get referrals from families because they've been to their gastroenterologist, they've been to the local medical centers, and the treatment's still the same, the vancomycin. They may have problems with diarrhea for weeks with that. And I treated a number of these people by taking them off their vancomycin, putting them on probiotics, giving them good nutrients that'll support the gut, things like L-glutamine and good products that have 30 or 40 different things that will supply nutrition to the gut, and then watch it recover. And usually within 4 or 5 days, the C. diff is gone, the diarrhea is clearing up, they're getting their energy back, and they're starting to eat again. And that's happened in every case. I have to knock on wood here. Every case so far that I've treated of C. difficile, including 6 cases in my local hospital where the gastroenterologist didn't think that they could solve the problem. And they'd heard me big-mouthing around about how I could solve that problem by doing something totally different. So they gave me a shot at it. And every one of them responded to it within a week.
I wonder if they use probiotics in their practice now.
They're starting to. I remember talking to one particular gastroenterologist. This had to be 10, 12 years ago. And there was a case of somebody having H. pylori. And he said, well, if H. pylori is there, you've got to treat it. And I said, don't be silly. Everybody has H. pylori from time to time. And now we know that 50% of the population does. And it's only a small percentage of people who have ulcers from that or who have a gastric cancer from that. And now we find out that H. pylori protects against what? Colitis and other interesting things that we get that make it very interesting.
So we can't just be making assumptions.
No. And you don't just treat everything that you've just learned about and think that it's the right thing to do. So that's what we need to know. Anyway, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The lines are open. The number is 888-874-4888, and it's time for Vicki's 2020 tip.
Oh, I have a little something here about good judgment, how it comes from experience, and a lot of that comes from bad judgment.
Yeah, indeed.
Have you ever realized that letting the cat out of the bag is a whole lot easier than putting it back in?
Indeed.
After eating an entire bowl, a mountain lion. He felt so good that he started roaring, and he kept it up until a hunter came along and shot him. Well, the moral is, when you're full of bull, keep your mouth shut. Yeah. I have a few things on growing older now, because eventually you'll reach a point when you stop lying about your age and you start bragging about it. The older we get, the fewer things seem worth waiting in line for. When you're dissatisfied and you'd like to go back to youth, just think of algebra.
That's right. I don't think I want to relearn all the things I had to learn when I was 20.
You know, you're getting old when everything either dries up or leaks.
Oh, dear.
Being young is beautiful, but being old is comfortable.
That's for sure.
Well, if you don't have aches and pains.
Well, yeah, but that's nothing to do with beauty. You're right.
Long ago, when men cursed and beat the ground with sticks, it was called witchcraft. Today, it's called what?
What?
Golf.
Golf. Yeah, that's true.
If you don't learn to laugh at trouble, you won't have anything to laugh at when you're old. So don't take life so seriously, because laughter is the best medicine.
Indeed. That's really neat that you cheer us up, you know, a couple times through this hour, Vicki. We're talking about so many serious things that sometimes you can get at a downer. Anyway, this is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888.
Inflammation is associated with chronic disease, and a new study shows that sweets increase inflammation.
Isn't that something?
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of this has to do with glycemic index. So I was thinking maybe what we could do is start out by talking about what glycemic index means, because some of these foods that have a higher glycemic index are the ones that are like, you know, the white flour and the sugar and
the high fructose corn syrup.
Corn syrup and that kind of thing. And the lower glycemic index are carbohydrates that are complex carbohydrates, mm-hmm. that don't digest as quickly, things that are higher in fiber like beans and lentils
it's the story of the fruit. They put the fructose in it, that's the poison for us, and then they put the fiber in it, which is the antidote, and then we have something that we can consume and it doesn't cause big problems, although yeah. excessive amounts probably would. In this particular study that was done on 80 people with two 28-day feeding cycles with high and low glycemic index foods, what they found was, is if you're on a diet that was not likely didn't have much in the way of simple sugars, and not likely to cause a rise in glucose that was quick, the amount of C-reactive protein that was there, which is a marker of inflammation, dropped by a fifth, by about 22%. So we're looking at something that is probably a surprise to a lot of people, to know that there's such a direct relationship between what you eat in the form of simple carbohydrates, particularly high fructose corn syrup, and your risk for having an inflammatory process that leads to heart attacks and strokes and type 2 diabetes and cancer and all the things that are in these chronic diseases that we're seeing.
You know, another thing that I thought was kind of interesting, we were just at the celebration of a good friend's life that mm-hmm. Just died recently, mm-hmm. and we saw his daughter there, and we're asking her what she's doing, and she's doing these studies on a hormone
called
adiponectin.
Yeah.
And we're like, we just read an article about adiponectin and how eating a low glycemic diet increases adiponectin and protects us against cancer and diabetes and heart disease.
All these inflammatory processes.
Yeah.
it helps keep from forming plaque, which is good. It increases the effectiveness of insulin. It lowers our triglyceride levels, and it's anti-inflammatory. So that was kind of a small world. It was interesting to see this.
Who else would have really heard?
The pediatric endocrinologist who's doing studies on pretty much this, along with some clinical practice. Anyway, carbs are not created equal. I mean, some carbohydrates are really bad for us, and we'll talk a bit more about that. In fact, it's maybe a good transition into it, where we're looking at sugar and the form that you eat has a lot to do with where fat goes.
And well, like if you drink a lot of sodas, for example, because uh-huh. sodas are just loaded with sugar, mm-hmm. unless you drink the other kind that's not so good.
There's no kind of soda that's good for you. That's
right.
There's no kind of soda.
Too, but we're not talking about that right now.
Right.
But anyway, This study found that the sodas actually deposit fat in the liver and the muscles and also around the organs in the belly.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, well, that's what they should feed the cows then, is give them soda so the meat's marbled. Because doesn't that make juicier meat?
Yeah, it does.
When it's higher in fat?
Yeah, I don't think we want to go there.
I'm just kidding.
Yeah, that's a good joke.
But
you're
right. Basically, that's what it's doing, is it's marbling our fat. And when you think about...
Marbling our meat. Yeah, our muscles.
Yeah, and also... Oh, yeah, that's what I meant.
Yeah.
Marbling our fat. That's what the fat is.
Right.
So it's marbling our muscles, but also the fact that it's creating fat around the organs in our belly. And so it's crowding our organs so that they really can't function as well. And it's also a dangerous kind of fat, which is called ectopic fat, as opposed to subcutaneous fat, which is the fat that we just get underneath our skin.
Mm-hmm. Well, that puts us at risk for the metabolic syndrome, for diabetes, heart attack, strokes, hypertension, fatty liver disease. And what this particular article showed, which was published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, is if you drink a liter a day of soda for 6 months, okay, I don't know who's going to do that. But there are people doing that.
Well, that's four glasses. A lot of people do that. They have it in the morning instead
that's
of coffee.
True.
And
true. I've had a couple of people who have had more than probably 2 liters a day. These are people who are really obese. And what they found is that not only were these was there an increase, but it was 27% of an increase. And people, if they were overweight or obese to start with.
Well, think about it. When you go to, I don't go to these fast food restaurants, but I've seen people carrying these big containers, these big plastic cups that look like they're about a liter.
Right.
A half a liter. They're huge glasses.
Well, that's right.
And then some of the restaurants will let you get free refills.
Yeah, that's
to get
great.
You to come in.
That's great. They'll give you more. You can eat all you want of this poison, and we'll give you all you want for free.
But doesn't high fructose corn syrup also increase your appetite?
It does. It makes your brain think that it needs to eat more. And, of course, the big thing with it is that the body treats fructose different than glucose. Not all sugars are the same. And the way it treats fructose is that it turns it into fat 40% faster than glucose does. You have to keep in mind that sugar is made of two, sucrose is made of two sugars, glucose and fructose, but they're connected, okay, into by bonds, so that they exist together, A monosaccharide is a single sugar, so glucose would be a single sugar, and so would fructose. A disaccharide means that these are formed in a compound together, so that they exist and have chemical bonds holding them together. High fructose corn syrup is glucose and fructose by itself as monosaccharides. So the sucrose has to be broken down by the body, but high fructose corn syrup, it's not. That fructose just comes in. And when it does, there's no way to keep the fructose from turning into fat, as there is, because the body can handle glucose in a different way. When glucose comes in, it does there are regulatory processes that hold it in check, so that the body will burn it preferentially and keep it around for a while before it turns it into fat. But with fructose, it just goes straight into the process of turning it into fat. So the only people who can really tolerate things that are high fructose corn syrup are people who are really exercising an awful lot.
I think it's interesting to note that the sodas in Europe are different than the sodas in our country, because the ones in Europe contain sucrose instead of fructose.
Yeah.
And ours contain this high fructose corn syrup. And
right.
Then we get ads on TV all the time telling us that it's healthy because it comes from corn. And we know that corn's genetically engineered besides, as a footnote.
Well, that's right.
It's not a healthy thing to eat or to drink, so make other choices, you know. I mean, even fruit juice is high in, a natural type of a fructose that comes from the fruit.
Well, that's right.
Those are high in sugar, too. It's better to eat the whole fruit, as we mentioned earlier.
Well, that's right. All right, well, it's time for a short station break. We've got a call waiting from Bobby from New Jersey. We'll get to Bobby when we come back. So you're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888 if you have a question about your health or just want to join in our conversation. Okay, we have a call from Bobby from New Jersey. Bobby, you there?
Yes, I'm here.
How are you?
I'm doing well. Good afternoon to you and your guest. I mean, your wife.
Yeah, she's a great guest, let me
Thanks,
tell you.
Thanks, Bobby.
So, in any case, Bobby?
You made a comment about H. pylori, and I was diagnosed with H. pylori. I wasn't exactly sure how I received it, but, you know, even the doctor wasn't certain. You know, he just gave me some suggestions on how it could possibly be transmitted with through flies, getting on your food or something like that was his basic suggestion. But you made a comment that it's not always fatal or it's not always cancer or ulcer derived. You can actually treat it with antibiotics. And I also have another question in terms of you had just talked about
Why don't we do that one first and come to your second question afterwards? Is that okay? Is that all right with you, Bobby?
Yeah, it's fine.
Okay, good. Well, first of all, H. pylori is a normal thing to have in your intestinal tract. Now, that's a surprise to most people. 50% of people who are tested for H. pylori have it. And only a very small percentage of people will have an ulcer from it or have a risk for developing cancer. So we have to keep in mind that it's where the H. pylori is that makes it dangerous or makes it useful. Because we know that H. pylori can also protect against inflammation. If you have something like ulcerative colitis or other kind of inflammatory problem in the bowel, this H. pylori actually protects against the inflammation. So now you have the question of, well, is it good or is it bad? And the question is, it depends on where it is and how much of it. Because like I was saying earlier, the ecosystem of the gut has got 1,000 different species of microbes in it, and they all wax and wane depending on how we treat our gut. We eat bad food, we're going to wind up with the wrong microbes overgrowing. If we're lactose intolerant, for example, and we feed ourselves a lot of milk that has lactose in it, then those microbes that love to have lactose are going to overgrow. It's the same thing with H. pylori. So just because it's there does not mean it needs to be treated. The only time I treat H. pylori aggressively with the mainstream approaches, which would be antibiotics and proton pump inhibitors and Pepto-Bismol, is when somebody has an ulcer that I can't resolve some other way. So I'm really much more lenient and understanding of the H. pylori microbe and tend to leave it alone if it leaves us alone, and not necessarily try to eradicate it. Does that answer that question for you?
Yes, it does. I need just a little clarity.
Good.
You said gut, and he said stomach.
The intestinal tract goes from the mouth to the anus, okay? The gut goes from the mouth to the anus. So it includes everything in there, that digestive tract.
All right, I just wanted to make sure we were on the same page with that one. You had talked about a new I don't know if it's a new herb, llama, that they were testing in terms of taking care of fat. I was listening to
the leptin?
Yes.
Oh, the leptin hormone.
Right.
Yeah.
And Dr. Morris was talking about that. You just said you were just reading about it or just listening to a lecture with him on that subject. So I was kind of curious that you guys brought it up.
Yeah, it's coincidental. A lot of people are now starting to recognize the importance of this hormone, which is very powerful in suppressing our appetites. But when it's in low amounts, it tends to stimulate our appetite, but it's also associated with heart attacks, which is kind of interesting. And when they studied giving probiotics to people to prevent a heart attack, at least in rats so far. So the whole body, its biochemistry and physiology, is so complex that quite honestly, I don't know anybody who has a clue of how it all works together in a way that looks at the whole body. We know
just
little
to clarify,
pieces.
Low amounts of leptin reduce the incidence of a heart attack.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's right. So it's a lot of this is an enigma, and a lot of the times we see issues that we can't just make general rules about, like, and H. pylori is the great example of that. Should we knock it out with antibiotics? Should we try to just leave it alone and strengthen the gut, which is what I do in my practice? And I do that by giving certain kinds of nutrients that the gut likes, things like L-glutamine and products that have many different things that the gut likes. Maybe quieting it down with a little bit of quercetin, which is a bioflavonoid that helps to prevent the allergic reactions that occur in the gut. It goes back to that old argument that Beauchamp and Pasteur had a couple hundred years ago when Pasteur, who really discovered microbes, was saying it's the microbes that cause the problem. They invade the tissues and they make us sick. And it was Beauchamp who said, yes, indeed, that's true. But it's only that they're able to invade tissues when the tissues don't have good immunity and they don't have strength to be able to defend against the microbes. And we're still arguing about that today. And, of course, the common sense approach to this is to say, well, obviously, the problem is both. You don't want to have a suppressed immune system. You don't want to have tissues that don't have good immunity. But you also don't want to expose yourself to a lot of microbes that have the potential of being pathogenic. Does that take care of it for you, Bobby?
Yes. Now, if you have a clogged artery, you know, and you talked about inflammation and this helping to help with the inflammation, would that do it in small dosage?
Yeah, well, first of all, if we work like rats do, which I think we will in this case, that's my prediction anyway, but we don't have the data for it. Yeah, I think that a probiotic is a good thing. I think everybody should be on probiotics from time to time because, as I mentioned earlier in the show, that metabolic activity there is more than any organ system in the body, and our relationship to those microbes in the gut is profound. And it has an effect on asthma and allergic conditions. It has an effect on maybe heart attacks now we're looking at. So if we could nourish that ecosystem, those microbes that are there, with the microbes that should be there, the ones that are the friendly ones that are protecting us against other bad bacteria from overgrowing, I think it makes a lot of sense. So the answer is yes. I think just, you know, you can go to your health food store and just get a good probiotic and maybe take it every other day or a couple times a week just as a general thing, particularly if you're not eating a healthy diet or getting enough sleep or exercising right or you're exposed to a lot of toxins.
What about if you've had your appendix out?
I'd still do it. I mean, it doesn't matter.
I mean, I was thinking that might be a better reason to do it.
Well, it's another reason to do it, particularly if you've got an infection in the gut, because now your appendix isn't going to be able to be storing and secreting all those friendly microbes that we need to have in our gut. So, Bobby, it's good to talk to you. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
You have a good day. The lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. And we'll be back taking your calls after Vicki's next 2020 tip.
I have some observations on growing older. First of all, today is the oldest that you've ever been.
That's true.
Yet it's the youngest that you'll ever be.
Oh, there's an interesting
so
paradox.
So enjoy this day while it lasts.
And you'll enjoy every day. I'm with you.
You know, your kids are becoming you, and you don't like them. Have you ever noticed that? Some people have that problem.
Yes,
but if our kids are listening, we don't have that problem.
No, of course not.
Other observations on growing older. Going out is good. Coming home is better. You forget names, but it's okay because the other people forgot they even knew you.
That's right. We get so serious about that. I haven't seen this person in 20 years, and I can't remember their name. Well, they don't even care. Okay.
Your spouse is counting on you to remember things that you don't remember.
Yeah, that gets interesting, doesn't it?
Other observations on growing older are the things that you used to care to do, you no longer care to do, but you really do care that you don't care to do them anymore.
Oh, don't trouble me with that one. It's like one of your tongue twisters.
Your husband sleeps better on a lounge chair with a TV blaring than he does in bed. It's called pre-sleep.
Pre-sleep? Oh, jeez.
Now that you can afford expensive jewelry, it's not safe to wear it anymore.
Mm.
You notice everything sold in stores is sleeveless. You know, I was thinking last night they had the Golden Globes.
Uh-huh.
And these women, you know, most of them had beautiful arms.
Uh-huh.
You know, they show their beautiful figures and their arms and all that stuff. It's like you got it, flaunt it. You might as well. And then today they have talks on some of the other TV shows to go over the Golden Globes and everything. Well, Angelina Jolie looked absolutely beautiful to me.
Yeah, well, she is.
And they were criticizing her because they thought that her arms looked too muscular.
I'd rather have that problem than the problem they had.
Well, her arms look perfect to me. And I mean, yeah. Otherwise, you got flappy wings.
Flappy wings.
And they were making the same criticism of Madonna. I have seen Madonna at different times when her arms looked extremely muscular. But I thought last night her arms looked great. But anyway, it's hard to please the media.
Well, maybe it's better the way she sings than the way she looks. Could that be?
Whatever. I mean, to me, I'd rather have firm arms than flappy ones.
Okay.
What used to be freckles are now liver spots.
Oh.
And everybody whispers. Have you noticed that? When you get older, you can't hear as well.
Yeah, that's true.
And now that your husband's retired, you'd give anything if he'd find a job.
Yeah, that's the shock of retirement, huh? What do I do now? Okay. I'll tell you, in my case, I don't plan to ever retire because my work is a lot of what's important to me.
But a lot of your work is at home.
Hands, is that what that's about? You want me to go to the office? Is that the idea?
Here's some more on growing older. You have three sizes of clothes in your closet, two of which you'll never wear.
That's true.
But old is good in some things. Old songs, old movies, and best of all, old friends. And it's not what you gather, but what you scatter that tells what kind of life you've lived. So spread the love and the laughter and have a good day.
I'll tell you, I'd rather have my aches and pains, okay, and my limitations in what I can do, than have to go through what I had to go through to learn what I know today.
Yeah, but I wouldn't mind looking that way and feeling that way.
It's that way for a reason. You know, we oftentimes don't understand how nature works, but we know what the results are because we're affected by what happens.
And a lot of people say, well, we've earned our wrinkles.
Well, indeed. Indeed.
Yeah,
I mean, I would not want to go back.
That doesn't mean you want to.
No.
But that's because, you know, there's so emphasis put on being young and beautiful. And so I think there needs to be more emphasis the other direction, because as people get older, then they're not happy with how they look.
Well, you could have a choice, right? You can do what you want. I'll take my crinkles and wrinkles and aches and pains and forgetting some things, because I know I'm smarter than I've ever been. I'm at the peak of my life in terms of what I know and how I can help make the world a better place. And to me, that's far more important than looking like Rock Hudson or something. You know, it's just not, it's not on. I mean, those are, to me, relatively superficial things, but I understand that we all have a very powerful need to be appreciated for our looks as well. You know, what looks we have. So that's a good point, bring up stuff like that. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888.
So can you die of a broken heart?
Well,
it's interesting.
I would die of a broken heart if something happened to you, Vicki.
I would too.
It's amazing. It took us a while to get here, didn't it?
Yeah. Well, today is our anniversary, 33 years.
Hey, we'll get a little bottle of wine. We'll go out for dinner, maybe watch a movie, and come home and celebrate some more.
Dream on.
What do you mean, dream on?
Back to growing older.
That's right. That's one thing that doesn't change a whole lot, although it doesn't run my life like it used to. That's a relief. Jeez, that was something that was awful.
Anyway,
think about it.
Your risk of a heart attack increases 21 times in the first 24 hours after your loved one dies, and it goes up 8 times
for the next week,
uh-huh. And it still, you know, increases for a month, not as many times as 8 times or whatever,
mm-hmm.
but That's pretty remarkable. I mean, that's really high. I think if you lose a parent and the other one's still around, you better not leave them alone. You better keep checking on them because you might lose both parents together. Think about the movie The Notebook.
Mm-hmm. Well, they died together.
Yeah, he crawled in bed with her and they both died together.
Well, that's a nice fairy tale kind of thing.
But things like that happen. You hear about it in life, and it happened with my great grandparents. My great grandfather was sick in bed, and my great grandmother went downstairs to get him something. Uh-huh. And when she did, she tripped and fell down the stairs and broke her neck.
Oh, wow.
And my grandparent, and the children, I mean, they all didn't know what to do, so they just carried her upstairs and put her in bed, and in the morning they were both dead.
Yeah, well, we hear stories like that all the time. You're right, and it just shows you that, you know, relationships are complicated. They're not all, none of them are perfect. I mean, most of them have lots of dysfunctional aspects to them, but when push comes to shove, the deep relationship, particularly when there's trouble, is what supersedes everything else.
You know, it's interesting, too, because a lot of people will say things are just psychosomatic or they're just psychological. But psychological can be very powerful. And they did this study at Harvard on 2,000 patients over 5 years. And it showed that when this happened, that blood pressure increased, heart rate increased, and the coagulability.
The stickiness of blood. The stickiness
of
blood.
The blood, yeah.
It went up. And so you're at a much higher risk for having any kind of obstructive event in an artery, which could cause a heart attack or a stroke. Yeah, that's a big thing.
So
there was a study done years before that showed that stress like this that we're talking about, where one person dies, it's very close to you, caused a change in the heart muscle so that it went into shock. They call it a stress cardiomyopathy. And it was the cortisol, adrenaline, and the noradrenaline that caused the shock that leads to congestive heart failure that's temporary. So you could have nothing wrong with your arteries at all and throw your heart into shock because of all the stress that you're putting on it, leading to temporary congestive heart failure. And if you can get past that acute setting, you'd survive and you go back to being normal again.
So an emotional broken heart can lead to a physical broken heart.
Oh, absolutely. Literally. Absolutely. It can cause obstruction of an artery to cause a heart attack. It can cause shock to the tissues, which makes it not function, not able to contract well, and lead to congestive heart failure. And, of course, grief is something that causes depression and anxiety and anger, and it's really a big deal to go through.
So maybe the probiotics would be helpful in this case also.
No, I think probiotics would be good in general. I think that would be something people should do pretty much every day or a couple times a week. And that's just about everybody because we all have stress in our life. We're all exposed to toxic chemicals. And from time to time, we take antibiotics by mouth that just destroys that whole system. So we should be doing what we can to restore that so that it can protect us against a lot of the illnesses that we're facing that we talked about today.
Anyway, I think that some sort of grief counseling
is
important.
And support from the family.
And, you know, if a person has gone through hospice, for example, mm-hmm. and they lose their loved one through mm-hmm. hospice offers a wonderful service.
It's all free, too.
Support.
I mean, it is
for the entire family.
Yeah, and it they offer that at no cost for a year after the person's dead, too. So it's like a real service to the community.
And I think people need to be careful about offering sedatives to someone that's a widow or a widower like that, because many times people are so depressed they're liable to take the whole bottle of them, you know what I mean? It's better to offer some herbal sedatives.
I think that's right. I think in general that's absolutely right, because what we do is we get so engaged in wanting to do something. You know, but it's not the best way to go about it. That's when people need your support. They want to be with you, and you need to.
And especially
to be there
when
for
you
them.
Hear these statistics that your risk of a heart attack continues to go up for a whole month. So
yeah.
You better check on them and hang out with them.
Oh, there's real biochemical changes that affect your physiology and your risk for certain kinds of problems. There's no question about that. Anyway, the lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Spudio with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. We have a call from James from California. Hi, James.
Hi, Doctor.
How are you?
I'm doing good, but I have a small or a big problem. I'm not sure yet. I'm from Burlingame, California. I've been to your office before.
Is that right?
Yes. Well, I'm a local guy for you.
Well, that's great.
I'm the big, tall, old guy.
Oh, I got a lot of those, James. anyway, what's happening?
Anyway, I have I just had a blood test done. It's the LP, lipoprotein.
LP little A?
PLA2. I have a very high reading of 320.
Okay.
And the reference range is from 81 to 259.
Okay.
Is that a big, significant problem? And
well,
if it is, how do I lower it?
If you didn't do anything about it, that would be a big concern. But, you know, what you're really concerned with here is probably in large part the coagulation of blood. What we're looking at is risk of heart attack and stroke, probably primarily stroke with that test. And what I would do is I would get a live blood cell analysis. And you're not too far from the person that I recommend do it. Her name is Beverly Rubick. She's a PhD in biophysics from UC Berkeley.
In Emeryville.
She's in Emeryville now. And she does a live blood cell analysis and a couple of other tests that I would recommend you consider. The live blood cell analysis, you know, is looking at blood in the living state using a dark field microscope at 8,000 power. And so what she does is she puts a little needle in your sticks to your finger to get a little blood out, puts it in a slide and looks at it while it's alive, okay, under that magnification. And what you'll see is how much there is in the way of coagulability, how sticky the blood is.
Because if
blood tends to stick together, you know that if you're at risk for having a heart attack or stroke because you have arteriosclerosis, that this may be the final blow. That makes the heart attack occur because it's usually a clot that sticks to a sticky part of the plaque that's there and then obstructs the blood vessel.
Oh.
And so that would be something you definitely would want to know.
Okay.
And if that's the case, then there are a lot of things that we can do in nutritional medicine to solve that problem that aren't so dangerous.
Like fish oil.
Well, fish oil would be one. Nattokinase is another. And there are other kinds. Lumbrokinase is another one that I think work pretty well in a safe way. And you can do what we call a stress live blood cell analysis, where what we do is we look at the blood, see if it's clotting, and if it's clotting too much or there's too much fibrin in it that tends to make blood clot as well. Then we'll go ahead and give you either one or two capsules of fish oil. And if that solves the problem, we're done. But if it doesn't, then we'll follow that by giving you a couple of capsules of nattokinase, and usually that will do it. And if it doesn't,
then
we'll combine them together.
And then you look at the blood again right after you've taken it, and then that shows.
Well, it takes an hour after each one so that you can absorb it and have its effect be measured. So that's what I would do, James, to be able to be sure that you're getting the anticoagulation effect that you need. Then the other two tests she does look at vascular stiffness, and also look at heart rate variability, which are tests that are very predictive for heart attack and stroke, and all-cause mortality, for that matter.
Oh, okay. So she's in Emeryville then, huh?
Yeah, you could just call the office.
Okay.
You know, call the office and talk to Gabrielle let her know that you'd like to see Beverly Rubick. Or you can come by and we can talk about it. You know, it's another thing I haven't seen in a while.
Yeah, it's been a while.
And just kind of bring things up to date.
I remember you used to call us when we were on KEST.
Right, yeah, and I was in your office about three or four times.
Yeah, met you, too.
Yeah, well, I look forward to seeing you again, James.
Guy,
it's been a while. You know, every now and then, it's good to check in with your doc.
Yeah. Okay.
All right, you have a great day.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Okay, take care. Bye. Bye-bye. Okay, so these are all topics that this has been a good show. I love talking about these kinds of things because they're practical. They're not what's done in the mainstream for the most part. And they add to what we have in the mainstream, which is beautiful form of medicine, but just a little bit too aggressive, a little too dangerous, a little too expensive.
Well, we never did get to the maggots.
Oh, the maggots. The maggots, that's right.
There was a study, just
quickly
saying.
We did this one really quick.
Where they can debride diabetic wounds very well. In fact, they can do it as well as surgery. And, of course, with surgery, you have to go under an anesthetic and that kind of thing. But it's just kind of interesting to note that there's a place for insects. You know, like leeches can help with osteoarthritis.
Mm-hmm. And bees can work too. I mean, there's bee sting therapy, and it sounds like it's crazy, but I can guarantee you that it works, and it's something that we should keep in mind as maybe a last resort, because bee stings aren't exactly a fun thing to do. But you can order bees, okay? They'll come to you in the mail, and you put them on your skin, and yes, they'll do you the favor of stinging you.
I hope our neighbor doesn't do that.
I hope not, too.
But the photon stimulator works very well in diabetic wounds also.
Oh, for diabetes, there's nothing like it. Infrared light therapy, and for those of you who want to learn more about that, go to the website at Dr. Saputo, that's D-O-C-T-O-R, Saputo, S-A-P-U-T-O.com, and put in infrared light therapy. And if you've got diabetes and you've got neuropathy, or you have chemotherapy-induced neuropathy, or wounds that need to be healed, this, in my opinion, is the cat's meow, because it happens really quick. So that's that topic. I'd like to remind you that we'll be back to live to talk to you about what's new in the news in health, and to take your health questions every Monday afternoon on PRN.FM and DrSaputo.com from 3 to 4 Eastern Time and from 12 to 1 Pacific Time. Prescriptions for Health is also archived on DrSaputo.com as well as PRN.FM.
And if you enjoyed today's show and you'd like to have more information on the topics we discussed, go to DrSaputo.com and check out our Fast Track videos. And remember, lifestyle is the most powerful healer in the universe, so if you want to be well, pay attention to the style in which you live your life.
Have a wonderful week. We'll see you next week.